My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Hello, my beautiful people. Welcome to another episode of Knowing is Knowing. I'm your host, Rashad Young, and as always, I appreciate you guys tuning in to another episode. Man, today's episode was so great. It was so phenomenal. I had the opportunity to interview author and writing coach Maya Douglas, who writes in the area of Christian romance, which I thought was really interesting to navigate. We talk about mental health, her books, her journey with faith, so many great things. Much love and respect to her, and also shout out to Philadelphia because that's where she's from, and Philadelphia is close to my heart as well. You guys will enjoy this, man. If you're trying to figure out your life, you're trying to figure out your faith, you're trying to figure out your journey, if you're a writer that has aspirations in getting into the writing space, this is the interview for you. Her information will be in the episode description link below. Make sure you check out her stuff, give her a follow, purchase her books. Again, super amazing conversation. Also, make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favorite audio platform and subscribe to me on YouTube. Thank you guys so much. God bless. Enjoy the episode. Till next time. Peace.
Thank you so much, Maya, for joining. I'm super excited to connect with you on this episode. One, because you're an author. You've written multiple books. And as an author myself, I've always loved to get into the mindset of other people, but also I think you have a great story to what I know and what I've seen. And so I think people should get a chance to connect with you and who you are. And so the first question I ask all my guests is, who are you to the world?
To the world? Okay, that's a good question. So to the world, Maya K is a journalist, an author, a feisty North Philly girl, born and raised on the playground is where I spend most of my days, literally. I am down to earth, no nonsense, but very loving, very nurturing. I'm a safe space. To God, I'm a daughter. And my identity is rooted in that and not in what I do. So
I love that. So a little fun story. My mother and my mother's side are from Coatesville. So not too far from.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe like about an hour out.
Hour.
Mm-hmm. I always tell people, I tell my friends, like I have Philly in my blood just because of that. So I have a lot of aspirations and admiration for the East Coast. I would like to say, obviously, with everything you just shared, it's a lot of pieces, a lot of stories. It's a lot of different connections with identity to who you are. Mm-hmm. But how do we get to this point to where we are today? Take me to the backstory as a kid growing up. Did you know that you want to be a writer? You know, the connections of those parts.
Yeah, so I did. I remember being five and I was trying to write this story about talking dogs. And but I also had a deep love for medicine. And actually, I was pre-med when God switched my whole life around. Okay. And I was studying pre-med at Temple. So as a kid, I always had this large imagination. If you had a chance to watch the mental health journey, that was where I feel like the enemy was trying to attack my mind and use what God wanted to obviously use for good to turn it into something bad. And so grew up in a single parent home with a very hardworking mother. My mother started at Bell when it was Bell South. Now it's Verizon. So I saw entrepreneurship because she was also an Avon salesperson. So I saw that in my blood. And I was scarred as a kid at four. I was touched by another little girl, which opened me up to a world of things that by six, I ended up being addicted to pornography, right? So that imagination piece and that kid piece was kind of stolen at a young age. And so I had to find ways and outlets to be able to like be creative. And that's when I would find myself like in a room with my dolls, talking to myself, putting together stories out loud, just kind of creating all of these scenarios. And I was always a math and English girl. So I never really struggled in school. I was MG. I don't know if they had that across the nation, but I was mentally gifted. And so I would get taken out of a class every day, not for like having trouble learning, but because I would get done work early and I would talk a lot. So a lot of my childhood was built around going to the library, my mother making sure I was infused with knowledge, and even just being named after Maya Angelou, right? Who I met on February 4th, 2006. So like she, I think she just knew. I don't know. I think there was just something in her that knew. So I even would study Maya Angelou just to kind of know, okay, who's this woman I'm named after? And so writing and literature, I'm sorry, it's like a net. Writing and literature has always been like infused in my life, and the starting of it, I think it started with my imagination being so broad, and then when that scar happened, it kind of forced me into ways to create like a safe creative space. So,
Yeah, no, one, first off, thank you for sharing all that.
for sure.
That I appreciate the vulnerability. And also, I think when I think of writers, I do think of people that have these experiences that really are life altering. I mean, essentially, you kind of you grew up relatively quick and you're exposed to things relatively quick. So it started off essentially, I guess, as a way of expression. Unfortunately, you sound like through a traumatic experience. Where did it go from there? So I know it started with, writing about dolls. Where did it get to the lane of other parts of your imagination?
Yes, when I got to Temple, I did a dual degree program and went from community college to Temple, and I was a pre-med major, but I was taking journalism courses, and I was just like trying to find my footing. So the ultimate dream was to be the senior editor of Essence magazine, right? That was it. But I also didn't want to be a starving artist, and I figured I did have a love for, children and wanting to be a pediatrician or OBGYN, so it made sense because I figured I could write at night. Actually, one of my favorite writers a few years ago, Nia Forrester, she's actually a lawyer. So I knew that there were people who could do like the six-figure careers but still write at night, publish on Amazon. This was way before Amazon even allowed publishing. So, long and short, I'm taking these journalism courses, and the lawyer sends a friend of mine, and he was like, "Are you sure you want to be a doctor?" And like, not even a month later, I dropped the pre-med major, and my heart was already set. So I ended up having to do an extra year at Temple just to kind of fulfill the journalism requirements, take a year off. Then I go to Arcadia University for grad school, and I'm studying a master's in English. And all of a sudden, I take this writing for children's course, and that was it. That just sold me because I started in young adult. And I still write young adult, but mainly I write Christian romance. So that was what did it for me. It was like being in a class where we swapped chapters, we were able to critique one another. The program was set up to be able to take what classes you wanted. You had three foundational ones, but then you could pick and choose. So I took this writing for fiction, and then I took this writing for children, and it just gave me life. And that was when I started learning the agenting process and the publishing process. And I just went on this whole journey. But I actually wrote and finished my first full-length book when my mother had tongue cancer. So it always seems like my creative juices get hit when a traumatic experience happens. And it blows my mind. But I mean, I guess whatever it takes to get it done, you know.
No, I think I had a convo with a friend about that. I was telling him, I was like, as a writer, I couldn't take the last one I wrote when I was in a good place. I don't really think I can get any sort of creativity behind that. But you're in a lane of which I've always inspired to get into. I write nonfiction, like self-help, and I also write poetry. But fiction, I feel like requires a level of detail that I don't necessarily feel like I have the tools for. So for anybody who may want to be an aspiring writer in fiction, what are like some tools or ideas you would give them to kind of put that book, those books together?
So first of all, subscribe to my podcast, Writing to Win with Maya K. It drops on Thursdays. Actually, we just started tomorrow. We're recording this on a Wednesday, so tomorrow it'll be the second episode.
Okay, good.
And
Nice.
so tomorrow's episode is how to five things that are stopping you, like fear, how to overcome these five fears that are stopping you. And so one of the things that I tell aspiring authors who, even whether they're just starting or they're switching from one genre to another, is I think you have to identify like what may be blocking you from thinking you don't have the tools. Like you just said, I don't know if I necessarily have the tools that I would need to write fiction, right? But here it is. I don't know how long your books are, but you have written a book. So you're already 10 steps ahead of a lot of people. Anybody who can put pen to paper, finger to laptop, that would be the first thing I would say. Like, Look at what you do have. Don't look at what you don't have. Because a lot of writers go into this, and because we're so inundated with self-published books on Amazon, people compare themselves a lot. And so I try to encourage people to find what you have. Ask God what your special sauce is. I thought I would be writing children's. I had picture books, middle grade, all the things, but it was Christian romance that kind of elevated me, right? So there's a special sauce. I have a unique way, even though it is romance without like sex and cursing and all of that. My secret sauce is that I write down there, like my characters all have swag. So like my tagline literally is I write dope books over it. Well, no, my tagline in my Instagram is I put my pen to the globe and make the world turn. Right. And it's crazy because when God gave me that, I was like, what does that mean? And I hadn't even written my first full-length book yet. So that's one of those things where I believe what he was saying to me is, I'm going to take your pen across the world if you follow my lead. So the first thing would be to trust what you have. And if you are a Christian writer, my podcast is geared towards, faith-based writers, then you want to make sure you're asking God, like, what does this look like? I came out of Jeremiah 36 with the first episode, right? And what I said was, imagine if Baruch, if you read Jeremiah 36 in the Bible, imagine if Baruch had ignored the instruction of Jeremiah. So the Lord gave Jeremiah a word. Jeremiah repeated it to Baruch and told him to scribe the message because he was trying to lead the nation of Israel to repentance. Our pens can lead someone to repentance, to Christ, to, and even it's not about you having to write a Christian book to do that. You don't. You could be a therapist and write a book on healing, but the way that your anointing will touch that pen and touch the pages, it can literally lead somebody to change their lives and, to get saved or to even just keep from wanting to kill themselves. You just never know. So that's the second thing. You gotta narrow down your why. And you have to be okay with that. So the reason why you hear me not talking about how to write fiction is because I find a lot of writers, my clients, they're not struggling with writing. They're struggling with the internal stuff. That's what blocks a lot of people. You can't really do what God has called you to do if you're struggling internally, if you still got a lot of trauma, if you're still healing. It doesn't mean you can't start, but that's where I find most writers are blocked at. And so lastly, just to get a tip for the craft, I'll give three. Just to get into the craft part of it, I would say like start journaling, but make it creative. There's a such thing as creative nonfiction. So start journaling, but make it creative, make it fun. I literally write fiction, but I pull nonfiction themes out of my book. So I'll give a quick example, and I'll wrap this up. So The Essence of His Soul, that was the last book that I released that was nominated twice. So people was putting my name in nominations I know nothing about. And so they love it. That's the one that has 313 reviews on Amazon. So people love this book. And one of the things, both of the characters, the guy.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts. So I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Who's a basketball player and the woman, they're both PKs. And so one of the things that I pulled out and I wrote a nonfiction article on was the pressures of being a pastor's kid and then wanting you to go into a field that's not considered demonic. Because the female in the book is a music producer. And the guy, plays basketball, which is fine. Her father, because he never had a son, wanted her to do ministry, wanted her to take over, when he stepped down from the church. And so I pulled on it, how family pressures can keep you from obeying God. So, that's just another way. Like, make sure that you are writing creatively, even when you're writing nonfiction. Find a way. So the way I took fiction and turned it into nonfiction, you could take nonfiction and turn it into fiction. You just gotta have fun with it.
No, I think that's, I mean, those are, go ahead, you have something else?
No, I was about to say, oh my gosh, I have a perfect case study for this. There's a guy that I just met. Literally, he found me, ordered my book. We follow each other on Substack. When I tell you he is killing it, and I'm going to do a live with him on Instagram, he is like a dating coach. He is taking real life Christian advice for like Christian dating, and he turned it into a Christian romance book. It blows my mind how much every post he puts on Threads gets at least 100 likes, a bunch of comments, because he's talking about Christian dating, and then he turned it into a Christian romance novel. Look, it's crazy. It's bananas.
Wow,
He
that's
is eating right now. He is eating.
No, I love that. I want to stick to your faith for a second.
Sure.
That definitely sounds like God is the center of everything in your life. Has that always been the case? Was there a situation where you were challenged by faith, or this is just always how you've been since you've grown up?
So I was raised in the church, but I got saved April 24th, 1994. So I was 9. And
Okay.
I think I started to realize then, even at a young age, that something was prophetic about me. And I called it psychic because I was watching Unsolved Mysteries and all kinds of stuff I shouldn't have been watching as a kid. So I thought I was just psychic. I was like, how did I know that? So as I got older, I started kind of running from God. It was just like, I'm cool with loving you, reading my Bible and praying, but I ain't really trying to get all caught up in this ministry or leadership or whatever. And so, yes, it's always been a foundation, but I spent a lot of years running from the call, not necessarily God, but the call. And so I would say like at 27, that's when it hit me. And I gave God a real unconditional yes, like a real unconditional, like the kind of yes that has had your girl abstinent for 9 years. The kind of yes that like
Wow.
literally like your girl is now. I'm 40, so that's 13 years, but 27 is when I gave the real yes. It took a while for me to get here, but like the kind of yes where literally when God tells me to do something, even when it hurts, it's like if Jesus could obey to death, then I could obey in something God tells me to do for life. So,
Wow. That is
which part are you wowing?
Well, a couple of things. One, I mean, answering a call—that's—that's. That's, I feel like that's a hard thing to always navigate. I mean, I'll be honest. My relationship with God—I honestly just got baptized in October of 24. I'm 38
Nice.
now. Thank you.
Congratulations.
It took a long time. One thing you'll learn about me is I question everything. And I think also that's got me in a lot of trouble, but I just have a natural, I have a natural curiosity of how things operate. And I think from my 20s in particular, I had so many questions about God, my purpose, why am I here? Because I just felt like that, again, similar to you, like there's this gift, and I feel like I was put in these, weird situations where I feel like I had to, I was trying to figure it out myself. That's the best way I could put it. And I think I got to a point where I was like, I cannot do this alone anymore. So, ever since then, it's been unique in the sense of how things have got thrown at me. I think obeying God in the right way has been tough. So to kind of hear your obedience for such a long time, just in one area, but I know it's probably in other areas as well. That says a lot about you, and I commend you for that because it's a very hard thing to do when we have free will. So I guess my question for you more so is how. How have you been able to be obedient, or have the discipline to be obedient in that space?
So it's funny that you said that because that's what I was going to say. If you didn't ask, I was going to say, I don't want people to ever, and I do accept your compliment, but I never want people to thank me or applaud me for doing what we should do, right? So Romans talks about how it is our reasonable service to give God our all. After all he's done for us, it's the least we could do. So the way that I got to be obedient in every area of my life is because I saw what it was like to be disobedient, right? And while I wasn't responsible for what happened at 4, like they say, you may not be responsible for what happened when you were a kid, but you're responsible for your healing. So at some point when I started getting answers and I was older and I was in my 20s, I had to make a decision. So when you see what life is like when you're partnering with the enemy and you are a disciple, this is why I tell people to, it's okay to say you're a believer, but maybe you want to start saying you're a disciple because believers believe in Christ, disciples live for Christ. There is a difference. And so, yeah, it's terminology, but if you see it that way, then you're able to address things the way the disciples did or the way Jesus laid out for the disciples. So just on a real transparent, like North Philly tip, like growing up, in an urban environment where my friends weren't necessarily following God. I had to make a decision even in college as I got older. Like, it's cool, like, but I was seeing people die, and I'm not just talking about boys, like, or men, like women getting murdered in my city. And I was like, what is going on? And I was seeing people, you know, have a bunch of kids and guys not even sticking around. And I'm just like, there has to be more to life than this, right? And I think for me, it came with a lot of crushing and a lot of failing. But again, I wanted to know. I was like, I'm not gonna get to heaven and no, I wanna see what this is about. I don't wanna wait till I get there. It got to be worth it to follow you, God. And so when I started saying, I'm sure you've seen that post before where they say, like, I may not have gained a lot, I mean lost, or they say, like, I gained peace, I gained this, and I lost this. And so they talk about their experience with God and they say the things that they gained that may not have been necessarily tangible. So because I had went through so much hell and torment because of that touch and all the things that I went through that came after that, I was like, there has to be life that's better. And because I know Christ, I want to experience this. So it took a lot of crushing. It took a lot of me failing. It took a lot of me being disobedient, even in the midst of maybe one area I had matured in, but another area I was struggling in. And I think lastly for me, this is what I've been telling people. I just did a TikTok video the other day and I said, you know, you don't have the privilege of knowing how far the enemy wants to take you into destruction. You don't have the fine print to that contract. And I don't want my kids killing demons that I should have never been playing with. Because many of us, I think you're a millennial. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
It's always weird. I feel like I'm
Like
millennial.
kind of Gen Z, millennial. Okay. So
It's a mix.
this is the thing. Most of millennial, well, anybody millennial and after, Gen Z, millennial, we're in therapy. We're getting some type of help or healing, or we're reading books if we can't afford it. But how much, I'm not saying we wouldn't need it, but how much will we not need it as much if our parents had slayed the demons they should have slayed, if their parents had slayed the demons they should have slayed? So some of us are in therapy killing stuff we had nothing to do with. So my obedience is worth my future children not having to kill a devil that I should have never been playing with in the first place. Because that goes back to my thing. You don't know how far the enemy wants to take you into destruction. So because it ain't touch you, you think you good. Oh, I did, I got away with it. But your kids may pay. Your future marriage may pay. Your future business may pay. So that's why I think people kind of don't have an eternity mindset. When you don't have an eternity mindset and you just think, oh, I'm having a good time. You know, even some of the 20-year-olds today, I mean, they have enough time in their lives, but it was different from when I was 20 to today's 20 and you having fun. It's way too much exposure, way too many more drugs, way too much just craziness. And so we got to redefine fun and we have to look at obedience not as God taking something from me, but as God making sure that he's adding something to my life, which if nothing else is peace. I have peace knowing that I am obeying God. God is not obligated to protect you in disobedience. So people be quoting Psalm 91, but you quoting Psalm 91 on the way to some guy house that don't care nothing about you. And you like, oh God, you know, I'm Psalm 91. And God is like, sis, I'm not obligated to protect you in disobedience. So yeah, I could go on and on, but you know.
This is not what I anticipated, but I also think is needed. I think there's a couple things that really sit with me. Man, the obedience part is always just a so it's a road. And you mentioned said the difference between being a believer and a disciple. Like that sat with me too. 'Cause it makes me think, especially like what I can always do better and how much I still have been leaning into my own understanding at once. And so that is profound. Like that is, I feel like I'm in church right now. Maybe that's exactly what I need. And also I think the bigger thing is too, for somebody a little bit about me also, like I'm taking the next steps to be a therapist and I'm also in therapy. So it's always funny when I have clients and when you're having these same conversations and the biggest thing you mentioned was access. We do have more access to things. And the other part too is knowing that at least for the younger people, 'cause I see it all the time and I hear it all the time, but it's like the dating aspect is so much different. And a question I do often ask, and I ask myself this in my own experience, like how much of myself have I given to this person who did not necessarily earn the rights
There you go.
or do it in the proper way. And like that's been the hardest pill I've been having to swallow lately. It's like understanding like where my heart is at and how I should be trying to live a life a certain way, but also doing things my own way and still getting the same result. So like living with that sense of insanity is very unique to see. So I think when you were saying that, it hit me a little bit harder because I'm like, she's not wrong. She's actually very, very right. So especially I think in a, from a personal sense, like having that prayer, the prayer that everybody does, the removal prayer, God, this isn't for me, remove it. And then when it happens, you're like, well, that's
Right.
not what I meant, not them. And like trying to have that faith and understanding that I think is important for us to have. So thank you for sharing that. That was really profound. I needed,
Oh,
I think I
sure.
needed, I think I needed to
Sure.
hear that. But since we're on the topic of mental health,
Yeah.
and I think just based off of just the stuff that you talk about, I would consider you a mental health advocate, in that sense. So why do you think it is important to kind of use your platform to talk to others about mental health? Like, why is it so personal to you?
Yeah. Well, I just want you to know you're very, I want to affirm you right now. I told my grandmother, my spiritual grandmother, who me and my mother live with, I was like, I got a feeling I'm going to minister to him. I was like, I don't know. I
You
did.
are.
Yeah, she was like, oh, you, she, because I ministered on a Sunday with a virtually with a group in Dallas, and her and my mom were sitting right here in the den across from me taking notes. She was like, that's just what you do. And I take it seriously. And I think going to, let me go to the mental health part, but I want to say this because there'll be a lot of women watching this. And I really want you guys to understand something. It is our job to create a safe space for our men. And it is not just your husband or your mate. You have to create safe spaces for your brothers, your uncles, your bosses. Like, it's not about getting personal with everybody, but when it comes to mental health, you know, men are becoming more or they're being more open and vulnerable and emotional. And the last thing they need is for a woman who they're connected to in whatever capacity to not create that space for them. And so if you can't say something that's going to be beneficial or encouraging when a man opens up, then don't say anything at all. And so I just wanted to throw that tidbit in there. And how that applies to mental health is because with a lot of our brothers, you know, I'll just use the term brothers because it's broad, going to therapy and working on themselves and finally having spaces to really open up and be vulnerable, you know, you guys are coming back to us and sharing your hearts. And so it messes with a man's mental when a woman castrates him with her tongue. Okay. So I just wanted to throw that tidbit in there for the mental health aspect. Now, as far as me being an advocate, I, with me having been delivered supernaturally from schizophrenia, and you know, I don't know if Rashad will put the link in. He doesn't have to, but you can go to my page when I give out my information at the end, and you'll see a testimony that I shared on another podcast, Voices of Victory, about my deliverance from schizophrenia. And I make it clear that while I never got a medical diagnosis, God used three different women, three different times in my life to literally confirm it, like by the word. And I had already heard it in my spirit, and I was so scared running from it. So God was chasing me down with the answer. And so it's important for me to use my platform because how dare I be silent when God has delivered me from what they would consider, and I'm not trying to disrespect the mental health profession, you know, I'm just using my own terminology, but they would consider schizophrenia to be the Bentley of mental like health issues, right? Like if you're dealing with that, that's like the high rankings. And because there's quote unquote no cure. That's what they say. But we serve a God who does whatever he wants. And so for me to hold in the testimony of how God took me through like almost a 15-year journey of deliverance and like, you know, less getting delivered one by one from the different spirits that oppressed me, and then also emotionally healing me, I just can't see that. When I hear someone talking about anxiety and depression, I have encouragement and answers for that. I'm not saying that you don't need to take medication. That just wasn't my route. I begged God for medication. I begged my mom to throw it to me. But I always say my mom was gentle parenting before gentle parenting was a term because she didn't do it. And I think a part of her just knew that I would either end up becoming worse, or just being codependent on it. And so I feel like when I share how God delivered me from such a disease that even some mental health therapists don't even want to touch, like there's therapists who don't even want to treat this. You know, they're like, nah, I'm cool. Like, you know, and so for God to have delivered me, it is my responsibility, it's my reasonable service, right? For me to share that there is a spiritual solution while if you're on medication, you continue with the natural solution. And when I hear the other reason is a lot of Gen Z, and it breaks my heart. Gen Z has a special place in my heart. So a lot of Gen Z is struggling immensely with anxiety and depression. And them having social media, or it was in, you know, kind of birthed in their generation, it doesn't really help. Now, social media is not the end all and be all of why, right? But if you, like, we went outside when I was a kid, we jumped up with us and certain things. So if you don't really have that, and then the pandemic didn't help, right? And so I hear so many kids, and when I hear young people committing suicide, young people being committed, young people going through that, I'm like, nah, I gotta start sharing this story so that they know that there's a God in heaven that really is like, no, yes, you may be dealing with this, but it does not mean that I gave it to you, right? And this is the other reason, going back to your previous question, why I don't play with the enemy, because I believe this disease entered my life through that touch, right? And while that wasn't my fault, you know, when you play with sin and you play with darkness and you keep on tabling and witchcraft and all this new age stuff, you don't know what he's going to bring your way, right? And so this goes back to why it's important to be obedient, because you have God on your side who can fight for you while you're walking in obedience. It doesn't mean you're perfect, but you're walking in obedience. So it makes me hurt to hear about a lot of young people killing themselves, not having the solutions that they want or need. And so sharing my story, it just makes it, to me, it gives them at least a reference point of a Black woman who was a young Black girl growing up in the hood like me, for, you know, a lot of the hood people, and to be like, wait, she's just like me, and she was able to overcome this. So I know I can overcome depression. I know I can deal with anxiety. If I have to get on medication, cool, but let me invite God into that process.
You said a lot, but a lot of beautiful things, which is good. When I look at when I hear about stories of schizophrenia, you're absolutely right. There is a lot of like, I don't want to touch that, or this person's crazy. The labels of it is unique, and I am also a firm believer that some of these things that we experience are based off of traumatic related events. I guess my next question for you, if you don't mind, is, when did you know, like, when did that third confirmation come in? Like, how old were you when that happened?
So I was 19 to 21 when all of them happened.
Okay.
That first one, I was sharing with my small group leader at the time. I was 19, and I was like, so here's what's happening. I don't know. It feels crazy. I was late 50 times in 11th grade, because what would happen is I would, like, just to like summarize it, I would be ready for school. Everything was cool, and then I would lapse, and I would just start like creating this fictitious world. And I would talk to these people like they were really there. Sometimes I would be older, like in maybe the lifestyle that I really wanted. Sometimes I would be my age, and then like I would look up and it would be 3 hours later, and it only felt like 10 minutes. And they have a term for that, I think, and they call it maladaptive daydreaming. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Yep. And so they didn't have language for it then. So I shared that with her, what I would know. That happened in 11th grade. Obviously, at 19, I was in college, but I gave her some references, and she was like, okay, God is telling me to tell you to watch A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe. If you've never seen that movie, it's he plays a real, like, this is a true story of the real life mathematician. I feel like his name was John Nash. And this mathematician was a professor. He was very brilliant, but he had schizophrenia. And this movie, I mean, Russell Crowe's performance in this film is, it's just mind, like, it's mind blowing how well he plays it. And what he was going through, I was like, okay, yeah, like those three people that he says he can't get rid of, that's me. And so then I kind of just I watched the movie, but she didn't give me any other steps. So I just, all right, well, at least I have a reference point. So she didn't say schizophrenia, the movie did. So then I go 20, I have a mentor organization at Temple, and I'm just ready to give up because I would have my most severe schizophrenic attacks like at the beginning of a semester. Nervous breakdown. I had to sleep with my mom because I kept literally like hearing the voices telling me to kill myself. I was walking on campus at Temple and I would rush through the class to keep from jumping off the building. Like it was bad. And so like I would wear sunglasses in class and stuff like that. And so I remember going to Reverend Geneva Hackett, who was also at the church, but again, these women didn't talk to each other. We had a big, pretty big, they would call it a mini mega church. And they didn't know I had talked to each of them. So I was telling Pastor Hackett, I was like, I think I want to give up. I don't know what it is. So she starts praying with me and then she says, I want you to start coming to the deliverance ministry. And she gives me this book called Pigs in a Parlor. And if you aren't familiar, all most deliverance ministries use it. There are some people, theologians, who have issues with it. I'm not here to dispute whether you agree or not. I know that book helped me. So she says, God is telling me to tell you to read the chapter on schizophrenia. I think it's chapter 21. So I was like, wait a minute, not again. Like, this is a year apart. Like, what are we doing? Like, man, I'm really offended. Like, y'all all trying to call me crazy. And then the last one, I ironically, Dr. Candy Stewart was, well, she is a board certified psychiatrist at the church. And so she just offered general counseling and I shared everything with her. So that's when she was the one, she never used schizophrenia. She said, didn't you say you wanted to be a writer? And I said, yeah. She said, that's what it is. The enemy is after your gift.
Yes.
So you are called to create fictitious worlds and fictitious characters and use your imagination. But he's trying to trap you into it in a way where literally that's what happens with a lot of people. If you ever hear of paranoid schizophrenia, from what I've studied, like some they lose time and they're like they might be in their homes all day. They never leave, some of them they might not leave. They're talking to themselves. I know it's different from split personality disorder, but
Right.
they can kind of intertwine. And so that's what happens to me. I was losing time and I'm like, oh snap, it's 11:30, let me get to school, like just waltzing in all normal, like nothing ever happened. And so when she started taking me through a few exercises, she didn't necessarily treat it. Because the church gives a couple of free sessions, but she started to walk me through this process where she was like, I want you to invite the main people you see all the time that you feel like don't let you live your normal life. And I want you to like one by one tell their thoughts in your life.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of it. That was that third confirmation. And I was 21. And that was kind of when I realized that if I didn't deal with this, the enemy. He would end up destroying my life. But see, I ended up playing around, didn't continue with the journey. And you know what happens when you play with deliverance? What do they say happens in Matthew? When the enemy leaves and you get delivered and you don't fill your house with, the Lord, he comes back and he brings seven demons with him. And when I tell you I suffered, and this is why I tell people, you either want, do you want a Band-Aid or you want freedom? At the time, I must have been looking for a Band-Aid. Because I went to her and then it was like, oh, I got it. Like I just thought I had it in the bag after a couple sessions. And I went through hell after that. It got worse because now the enemy never wanted me to tell anybody. So now that three women, it's exposed. Once the enemy gets exposed, he has to leave. So because I didn't feel my and I was still having premarital sex, I was still watching pornography, all the things, now he's coming back stronger. And so then the Lord said, okay, Israelite, I'm gonna take you the long way. So I ended up having to walk out my deliverance over 15 years instead of, I don't know how long it would have been had I just done it, done it with her the first time. But hey,
Wow. And that also makes me think about just the cycle of things, like when we're getting close to stepping into our call or doing the thing that God is asking us to do. And then, yeah, it's weird because I feel like everybody who struggles with that has that moment, like, oh, okay, I got it. Like you have just enough information where you feel confident enough to let go or let go of their hand. And then we just take a different route. And yeah, I think about, yeah, the seven demons that come into that. That is really profound. And I appreciate you sharing that. From a writing aspect, what is, if you do have any, what is your goal with this? Like, do you have an ultimate goal? Have you achieved that goal?
The writing.
Yeah, for writing.
So I just signed with my dream agent about 6 weeks ago.
Congrats.
Thank you. I would say, well, when I say dream agent, I mean her qualities. I'm not saying like a particular person, but I'm
Sure.
grateful. I'm repped by LaShira Lee of SBR Media. And honestly, I was good with self-publishing, and the book that I submitted to her, I was just like, God, I'm ready. I had the cover and everything. And this goes back to you giving God permission to do what he wants with your pen, because his thing is, I know that you're okay self-publishing. You've gotten a lot of rejections in the traditional world, but I have a need for this book. I need for women to stop saying that the dating pool has pissed in it. I need for women to trust me with their love lives, right? I need for women to do it my way. And you've written a story about a beautiful couple, including a man. I love sports romance. So he's a football coach and he's abstaining. Like, God was like, I need women to know there are men out there who really love me. And I need for women to read this book and see themselves in it, because I wrote like this hood girl. So it's like a girl who had a past, but she's, changed her life. And so my goal with, and that's called The War in His Heart, The War in His Heart. And my goal is to find a home, meaning like I want a publisher that I can be with for a very long time. And then to really get to the place where my books become some type of curriculum in a college or university, somebody who teaches, because there is I think some courses that people take, like family, if a marriage therapist, like if you're in that family, a marriage therapist, and you're in that field, you might could use the curriculum from the book to teach couples, whatever, to teach your students how to talk to couples or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I'm excited. I have a writer's devotional coming out June 10. I'm excited about that because I think a lot of writers need the spiritual and the practical direction. So it's a 30-day devotional. So I'm still going to be self-publishing things that are beneficial for other writers. That's where what I'm working on now, products for writers. But ultimately, I just really see myself being people's go-to in the Christian romance space, like that go-to person that people are like, if this Christian romance is Maya K, if it was banging, if it's on a New York Times bestsellers list, is Maya K. And I don't necessarily aspire to a list, but I just know some of the things God has told me. And then my prayer is to help the next generation write stories. Like it's sad how even on the, like people hear about the racism in Hollywood, because I'm in Hollywood too. Like I pitched studios and I'm pitching now, like, so I'm in Hollywood too. But people, yeah, so people see the racism in Hollywood, but nobody talks about the racism in publishing. And I was just posting some statistics. It's crazy the amount of white people who make the decisions and how our voices still are not as heard. And so I really want the generation behind me, Gen Z and beyond, to start to realize the power of telling a story, whether it's fiction or nonfiction or a memoir, and they have to take control. I would love to see more books out there and more people. So I'm doing a cohort. I'm going to do a cohort. Coaching is cool, but I would rather do like a class and like a cohort. If I could do that like 4 times a year with like 10 students, that would be great. So yeah, that's kind of just some recent, like some more immediate goals, but the long-term goal is for this show to get picked up.
Tell me more about the show. Is there
Sure. So I okay, so okay, let me be clear on what I can say, because
so I
Hollywood
know
has
you
all
can and
different
cannot say
perspectives.
everything.
Yeah. So this particular show, I have not gotten as far as I would like. So when I had pitched MGM Studios before, that was my young adult novel, I pitched them, right? So I had turned that into a script and I pitched them. So the same executive I'm still close to, and she is at a different studio, a better, well, in my opinion, a better studio. And I'm not saying that I'm pitching her, but I know that she offered to read it. And I believe that was God's way of opening the door. I did pitch it to an actor friend of mine who was on a family reunion, the show on Netflix. That's, my homie. And so I pitched it to him, because you just never know who people know, and they keep their ear open for what is being looked for. So the show is really an intergenerational show that tells the story of these three sisters. It's called Grace's Daughters. Their last name is Grace, and these three sisters who are going through different challenges in life. And of course, their parents are right behind them. So if I had to describe it, it would be like Seventh Heaven meets Girlfriends.
Wow, I like that.
Yeah, so that's probably all I can really say, but
No, for sure. I get that.
that's the best way to explain it. Like in Hollywood, we do comps just like in publishing. Like Seventh Heaven meets Girlfriends, because they're sisters, but they're like girlfriends, a
Yeah.
best friend.
No,
But
that
I would
makes
love to
sense.
tell you more about the book, you know, when you're ready. Like the book that I signed with my agent, yeah, I would love to tell you more about that. Oh, okay, so The War in His Heart. I actually took the war is his name, Warren Angel Roberts. I did
Okay.
that on purpose. I'm like real picky about stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it tells the story of Warren Roberts, who is a football coach, and he lost his wife years ago, and he's trying to find this balance and this groove because he knows that he has put football in the place where God belongs. And so he's making a decision at the beginning of the book to retire. But he's in therapy. He goes to his first therapy session, and you know he's like, man, something, I need something. And he is so afraid to let God heal this wound. So he meets Khadijah Hughes, who is a Philly girl that used to be the bait girl for the guys. You know, she would be the bait and they would go rob people. And so now she's like a millionaire business owner who owns her own nail polish line. And the way that they meet is so unique because his daughter, his teenage daughter, Daylin, they go to her, she has like a anniversary party at her bookstore, and that's how him and Khadijah meet. And so the story really is us, it's a forbidden love. If you love forbidden love, where people say you shouldn't be with that type of person, forbidden love stories is sports romance. Of course, I don't have a release date because my agent is shopping it, but if you follow me, you'll start to see me drop like different. I'll start marketing early, you'll start to see me drop quotes from the book, and I'll turn it into nonfiction and ask real life questions. So I'm excited about that.
I'm excited for you. I really am. I think
Thank
that's
you.
it's really cool to see people kind of at the door where they're trying to get to. I mean, it's the simple
Wow.
fact that you're even trying to pitch a show like that's super impressive. So I really am praying for you to hopefully get those things happen, man. I think that's cool. And like you mentioned, from a Hollywood and publishing standpoint, the percentages are so low for us as Black people, especially to get into those doors. So the fact that you do have people within those doors, that's definitely God's way of, hopefully giving you that opportunity. I think you so well deserve. And so I usually have a question that I ask all my guests before we wrap up. I think it's a profound question because I'm always intrigued to hear other people's perspectives. And the question is, what does it mean to be human to you?
What does it mean to be human to me? Okay, so it means to recognize that you are made in God's image and likeness. And that's a big deal because I think people, we operate like we're not. And being made in his image and likeness is a privilege, right? And I'm not just saying that to be like super spiritual. That's the reality of it. I also believe being human is being completely raw and vulnerable in who you are 365, like 24/7. And to show up in that fully, meaning that sometimes you'll be naked in front of people. But to be human is to know that nakedness, that vulnerability is actually helping other people in their humanity, because you have feelings, you have emotions. And I think we're seeing far too many people act like robots. As it is. And so to be human to me is to really step into that rawness, that full form and that full range of how God made us, like complete creatures, to be able to cry, laugh, be sad, even depression, right? It's not as horrible as people make it is if it's debilitating, but even that has its place. If you lose a parent, you're going to be a little depressed for a minute. So just being human is just really knowing that you're made in his image and likeness, God's image and likeness, and acting like it, carrying yourself in a way that makes him proud. You know, we don't need Genesis 6 to happen again, where he wipes out the whole mankind because we out here acting crazy. So it's just recognizing that we're made in his image and likeness and really embracing the full rawness of that. I mean, I think lastly, what it means to be human is to be loved. Like, it's a lot of hate. And we got to start putting honor back on people, even if they're not acting honorable.
That was well said. I enjoyed that answer, and that's one of my favorites so far in
Oh, thank
this
you.
run of interviews. And so I really appreciate this conversation. I feel like you've spoken to me in several different ways, and I'm gonna sit with and probably talk to my therapist tomorrow. Like, yeah, I interviewed this lady named Maya. She dropped some things in my heart that I need to really sit with and unpack. So I do appreciate that. For those who can't find you on social media, where can they find you at?
Yeah, so at Writer Maya, WRITERMYA. That's also my website where you can sign up for the email list. So that's at Writer Maya, writermaya.com. That way you can get writing tips. Make sure you do follow the podcast, Writing to Win with Maya K, which drops every Thursday. And just be sure to, I think people need writing coaching more than they give themselves credit for.
Yes.
One thing I'll say is don't skimp on investing in your writing. People, when they hear rates, they're like, oh my gosh, it costs that much. But I'm like, a writing coach is no different from a life coach. It's just a different area. So if you can invest in your writing, I have not had a client yet that has invested in their writing and that has not soared in some way, shape, or form. So, yeah, come follow me and keep writing, people, if you're writing, keep healing and all that. Keep praying.
Writing, healing, praying, all the important things. But Maya, I appreciate you joining. This has been another episode of Knowing is Knowing. Make sure to check out her wonderful stuff. I know she has a lot of great things coming soon. Hopefully, once the interview drops, this is the beginning of hearing great news for her and all the things she got going on. So appreciate you guys. Till next time, peace.